Toxin by Robin Cook, continued. Cassette 1, Side 2. No problem at all, Kim assured her. Quite the contrary. Your husband tolerated the procedure very well. He's being...
But it's almost 6 o'clock, Gertrude sputtered. You said you'd be done by 3.
That was an estimate, Mrs. Arnold, Kim said, trying to keep his voice even despite a wave of irritation. He'd anticipated a strange response, but this was more than he'd bargained for. Unfortunately, the previous case took longer than expected.
Then my husband should have gone first, Gertrude shot back. You've kept me waiting here all day, not knowing what was happening. I'm a wreck.
Kim lost control, and in spite of a valiant effort, his face twisted into a wry, disbelieving smile.
Don't you smile at me, young man, Gertrude scolded. If you ask me, you doctors are too high and mighty, making us normal folk wait all the time.
I'm sorry if my schedule has caused you any distress, Kim said. We do the best we can.
Yeah, well, let me tell you what else happened, Gertrude said. One of the AmeriCare administrators came to see me, and he told me that AmeriCare wasn't going to pay for my husband's first day in the hospital. They said he was supposed to be admitted this morning, on the day of the surgery, and not the day before. What do you say to that?
This is an ongoing problem I'm having with the administration, Kim said. When someone is as sick as your husband was before his surgery, I could not in good conscience allow him to be admitted the day of surgery.
Well, they said they weren't going to pay, Gertrude said, and we can't pay.
If AmeriCare persists, then I'll pay, Kim said. Gertrude's mouth dropped open.
You will?
It's come up before, and I've paid before, Kim said. Now, about your husband. Soon he'll be in recovery. They'll keep him there until he's stable, and then he'll go to the cardiac floor. You'll be able to see him then. Kim turned and walked from the room, pretending not to hear Mrs. Arnold calling his name. Retreating back up the hall, Kim entered the surgical lounge. It was occupied by a handful of OR nurses on their breaks and a few of the staff anesthesiologists and anesthetists. Kim nodded to those people he recognized. Having been working at the University Medical Center only since the merger 6 months previously, Kim didn't know all the staff, particularly the evening and night people. Pushing through the door into the men's surgical locker room, Kim pulled off his scrub top and threw it forcibly into the hamper. He then sat on the bench in front of the bank of lockers to unpin his watch from the waistband of the pants. Tom, who'd taken a shower, was busy putting on his shirt.
It used to be when I finished a case, I felt a certain euphoria, Kim commented. Now I feel a vague, unpleasant anxiety.
I know the feeling, Tom said.
Correct me if I'm wrong, Kim said. This all used to be a lot more fun. Tom turned from facing the mirror and chuckled.
Excuse me for laughing, but you say that as if it were a sudden revelation.
I'm not talking about the economics, Kim said. I'm talking about the little things, like getting respect from the staff and appreciation from patients. Nowadays, you can't take anything for granted.
Times are a-changin', Tom agreed, especially with managed care and the government teamed up to make us specialists miserable. Sometimes I fantasize about one of the responsible bureaucrats coming to me for a bypass, and I make him get it from a general practitioner.
Kim stood up and pulled off his scrub pants. The sad irony is that all this is happening when we cardiac surgeons have the most to offer the public. Kim was about to toss his pants into the hamper by the door when the door opened and one of the women anesthesiologists, Dr. Jane Flanagan, stuck her head in. Catching sight of Kim's skivvy-clad body, she whistled.
You came mighty close to having these sweat-soaked pants draped over your noggin, Kim warned.
For such a view, it would have been worth it, Jane joked. Anyway, I'm here to inform you that your public awaits you out here in the lounge.
The door closed and Jane's perky face disappeared. Kim looked at Tom.
Public? What the hell is she talking about?
My guess is you have a visitor, Tom said, and the fact that no one has come in here leads me to believe it must be female.
Kim stepped over to the cubbyholes filled with scrub tops and bottoms and took a clean set.
What now? He questioned irritably.
At the door, Kim paused. If this is Mrs. Arnold, the wife of my last case, I'm going to scream. Kim pushed out into the lounge. Instantly, he saw it wasn't Gertrude Arnold. Instead, Kelly Anderson was at the coffee urn,
helping herself to a cup. A few steps behind her was her cameraman, with a camcorder balanced on his right shoulder.
"Ah, Dr. Regis," Kelly exclaimed, catching sight of the surprised and none too pleased Kim. "How good of you to come to talk with us."
"How the hell did you get in here?" Kim asked with indignation. "And how did you know I was here?"
The surgical lounge was like a sanctuary that even non-surgical doctors were hesitant to violate. For Kim, the idea of being confronted by anyone here, much less Kelly Anderson, was too much to bear.
"Brian and I knew you were here thanks to your former wife," Kelly said.
"As for how we got up here, I'm happy to say we were invited and even escorted by Mr. Lindsay Noyes."
Kelly gestured toward a gray-suited gentleman standing in the doorway to the hall who'd hesitated to come in himself.
"He's from the AmeriCare University Med Center PR department."
"Evening, Dr. Regis," Lindsay said nervously. "We just need a moment of your time.
Miss Anderson has graciously decided to do a story commemorating the 6-month anniversary of our hospital merger. Of course, we'd like to assist her in any way we can."
For a moment, Kim's dark eyes darted back and forth between Kelly and Lindsay. On the spur of the moment, he wasn't certain who irritated him more, the muckraking journalist or the meddlesome administrator. Ultimately, he decided he didn't care.
"If you want to help her, then you talk to her," Kim said before turning to go back into the locker room.
"Dr. Regis, wait," Kelly blurted. "I've already heard the prepared AmeriCare side. We're interested in your personal view, from the trenches, so to speak."
With the locker room door open a crack, Kim paused and debated. He looked back at Kelly Anderson.
"After that piece you did on cardiac surgery, I vowed never to talk to you again."
"And why is that?" Kelly said.
"It was an interview. I didn't put words in your mouth."
"You quoted me out of context by editing your questions," Kim fumed, "and you left out most of the issues I said were of primary importance."
"We always edit our interviews," Kelly said. "It's a fact of life."
"Find another victim," Kim said.
Kim pushed open the locker room door and had taken a step within when Kelly called out again.
"Dr. Regis, just answer one question. Has the merger been as good for the community as AmeriCare contends? They say they did it for purely altruistic reasons. They insist it's the best thing that's happened to medical care in this city since the discovery of penicillin."
Kim hesitated again. The absurdity of such a comment made it impossible for him not to respond. Once again, he turned back to Kelly.
"I have trouble understanding how anyone could say such a ludicrous statement and have a conscience clear enough to sleep at night. The truth is that the entire rationale for the merger was to benefit AmeriCare's bottom line. Anything else they may tell you is rationalization and pure bull."
The door closed behind Kim. Kelly looked at Brian. Brian smiled and gave Kelly the thumbs-up sign.
"I got it," Brian said.
Kelly smiled back.
"Perfect. That was just what the doctor ordered."
Lindsay coughed politely into a closed fist.
"Obviously," he said, "Dr. Regis has given his personal view, which I can assure you is not shared by other members of the professional staff."
"Oh, really?" Kelly questioned.
She let her eyes roam the room. "Anybody here wish to make a comment concerning Dr. Regis's statement?" For a moment, no one moved.
"Pro or con?" Kelly prodded.
Still, no one moved. In the sudden silence, the hospital page could be heard like the backdrop of a TV melodrama.
"Well," Kelly said brightly, "thank you all for your time."
Tom slipped on his long white hospital coat and arranged the collection of pens, pencils, and flashlight in its upper front pocket. Kim had come into the locker room and, after removing his clothes and throwing them into the hamper, had gotten into the shower. He'd not said a word.
"Aren't you going to tell me who was out there?" Tom said.
"It was Kelly Anderson from WENE News," Kim said from the shower.
"In our surgical lounge?" Tom questioned.
"Can you believe it?" Kim said.
"She was dragged up here by one of the AmeriCare admin guys. Apparently my ex told her where to find me."
"I hope you told her what you thought of that piece she did on cardiac surgery," Tom said.
"After my car mechanic saw it, I swear he raised his rates. I mean, talk about backwards. My income's plummeting and service people are upping their charges."
"I said as little as I could," Kim said.
Hey, what time were you supposed to pick up Becky? Tom asked.
6 o'clock, Kim said. What time is it now?
You'd better get a move on, Tom said. It's already heading towards 6:30.
Damn, Kim said. I haven't even done my rounds yet. What a life.
Chapter 3. Friday, January 16th. By the time Kim did his rounds and checked Mr. Arnold in the recovery room, another hour had passed. En route to his former wife's house in the university section of town, he pushed his 10-year-old Mercedes and made record time. But it was still going on 8 when he pulled up behind a yellow Lamborghini directly in front of Tracy's house. Leaping from the car, Kim jogged up the front walk. The house was a modest affair, built around the birth of the 20th century, with a few Victorian Gothic touches, like pointed arch windows in the second-floor dormers. Kim took the front steps in twos to reach the columned porch where he rang the bell. His breath steamed in the wintry chill. While he waited, he fanned his arms to keep warm. He wasn't wearing a coat. Tracy opened the door and immediately put her hands on her hips. She was plainly anxious and irritated.
Kim, it's almost 8. You said you'd be here by 6 at the latest.
Sorry, Kim said. It was unavoidable. The second case took longer than anticipated. We ran into an unexpected problem.
I suppose I should be used to this by now, Tracy said.
She stepped out of the way and motioned for Kim to step inside. She closed the door behind him. Kim glanced into the living room and saw a smart, casually dressed, mid-40s man in a suede fringe jacket and ostrich cowboy boots. He was sitting on the couch with a drink in one hand and a cowboy hat in the other.
I would have fed Becky if I'd had any idea it was going to be this late, Tracy said. She's starved.
Well, that's easy to remedy, Kim said. I mean, we are planning on going out to dinner.
I wish you would have at least called, Tracy said.
I was in surgery and didn't get out until 5:30, Kim said. It's not like I was out golfing.
I know, Tracy said with resignation. It's all very noble. The problem is, you were the one who picked the time, not me. It's a matter of consideration. Every second I thought you were about to arrive. Luckily, we're not flying commercial.
Flying? Kim questioned. Where are you going?
Aspen, Tracy said. I've given Becky the number where I can be reached.
Aspen for 2 days?
I feel it's time for me to have a little fun in my life. Not that you would know what that is, apart from your surgery, of course.
Well, as long as we're being nasty and sarcastic, Kim said. Thanks for sending Kelly Anderson to the surgical lounge. That was a pleasant surprise.
I didn't send her, Tracy said.
She said you did.
I just told her I thought you were in surgery, Tracy said.
Well, it's the same thing, Kim said.
Over Kim's shoulder, Tracy saw her guest stand up. Sensing he was uncomfortable from undoubtedly overhearing her exchange with her former husband, Tracy motioned to Kim to follow her into the living room.
Enough of this bickering, she said. Kim, I'd like you to meet a friend of mine, Carl Stahl.
The two men shook hands and eyed each other warily.
You two entertain yourselves, Tracy suggested. I'll run upstairs and make sure Becky has everything she needs. Then we can all go our separate ways.
Kim watched Tracy disappear up the stairs. Then his gaze returned to Tracy's apparent boyfriend. It was an uncomfortable situation, and Kim couldn't help feel some jealousy. But at least Carl was several inches shorter, with significantly thinning hair. On the other hand, the man was tanned, despite its being midwinter. He also appeared in reasonable physical shape.
"Can I get you a drink?" Carl suggested, motioning toward a bottle of bourbon on a side table.
"Don't mind if I do," Kim said.
Kim had never been much of a drinker, although over the last 6 months a nightly cocktail had become a habit. Carl put down his cowboy hat and stepped over to the sideboard. Kim noticed he seemed to have a proprietary manner.
"I saw that interview Kelly Anderson did with you a month or so ago," Carl said, as he shoveled several ice cubes into an old-fashioned glass.
"I'm sorry," Kim said. "I was hoping most people missed it."
Carl splashed a generous dollop of liquor over the ice and then handed the drink to Kim. He sat back down on the couch next to his cowboy hat. Kim lowered himself into a facing club chair.
"You have a right to be angry about it," Carl said condescendingly. "It wasn't fair."
"T TV news has an irritating way of twisting things.
Sad but true, Kim agreed. He took a sip of the fiery fluid and inhaled before swallowing. He felt a comfortable, warm feeling course through his body.
I certainly didn't buy her premise, Carl said. You guys earn every penny you get. I mean, I personally have a lot of respect for you doctors.
Well, thank you, Kim said. That's very reassuring.
Seriously, Carl said. In fact, I was pre-med for a couple of semesters in college.
Really? What happened? Didn't you like it?
It didn't like me, Carl said with a laugh that ended with a peculiar snorting sound. It was a wee bit too demanding, and it began to cut into my social life.
Carl laughed again, as if he'd just told a joke.
Kim began to wonder what Tracy saw in the guy.
What do you do? Kim asked to make conversation. Besides, he was interested. Considering the lower middle-class neighborhood, the yellow Lamborghini outside had to belong to Carl. Plus, there was Tracy's comment about not flying commercial. That was even more worrisome.
I'm CEO of FoodSmart, Carl said. I'm sure you've heard of us.
I can't say that I have, Kim said.
It's a large agricultural business, Carl said. Really more of a holding company. One of the largest in the state, actually.
Wholesale or retail? Kim asked, not that he knew much about business.
Both, Carl said. But mainly export wholesale, involving grain and beef. But we're also the major stockholder in the Onion Ring burger chain.
I've heard of them, Kim said. I even own some stock.
Good choice, Carl said.
Then he leaned forward, and after furtively looking around as if he thought there were a chance of hidden eavesdroppers, he whispered,
"Buy some more Onion Ring stock. The company's about to take the chain national. Consider it an insider tip. Just don't tell anyone where you heard it."
"Well, thanks," Kim said. Then he added sarcastically, "I've been wondering what to do with all my discretionary income."
"You'll be thanking me 1,000-fold," Carl added, insensitive to Kim's tone of voice. "The stock is going to go through the roof. In a year's time, the Onion Ring will be out there challenging McDonald's, Burger King, and Wendy's."
"Tracy mentioned you two are flying to Aspen on a private plane," Kim said, changing the subject. "What do you fly?"
"Me, personally?" Carl questioned. "I don't fly. Hell no. I'd be the last person to get into a plane with me behind the controls."
Carl laughed again with his peculiar style, making Kim wonder if the guy snored when he slept.
"I've a new Learjet," Carl added. "Well, technically it's FoodSmart's, at least according to the IRS. Anyway, as you undoubtedly know, for such an aircraft, the FAA mandates we have 2 highly qualified pilots."
"Of course," Kim said, as if he were intimately aware of the rule. The last thing he wanted to do was reveal his ignorance of such things. Nor did he want to let on how angry it made him feel that a businessman who did nothing but shuffle paper could have such perks, while he, who worked 12 hours a day on people's hearts, was having trouble keeping his decade-old Mercedes on the road. A clatter of footfalls on the uncarpeted stairs heralded Becky's arrival. She had an overnight bag and her skates thrown over her shoulder. She dumped both onto a chair in the front hall before racing into the living room. Kim hadn't seen Becky since the previous Sunday when they'd spent a happy day at a nearby ski area, and Becky acted accordingly. She made a beeline into Kim's arms and gave him an enthusiastic hug, momentarily making him lose his balance. With his face pressed up against her head, Kim could feel that her brunette hair was damp from a recent shower. The remnant odor of the shampoo made her smell like an apple orchard in bloom. Without letting go of Kim, Becky leaned back and assumed a mock reproving expression.
"You're late, Daddy."
Kim's aggravations of the day melted as he regarded his darling, precocious 10-year-old daughter, who, in his mind, glowed with grace, youth, and energy. Her skin was flawless, her eyes large and expressive.
"I'm sorry, Pumpkin," Kim said. "I understand you're hungry."
"I'm starved," Becky said. "But look."
Becky turned her head from side to side.
"See my new diamond earrings? Aren't they gorgeous? Carl gave them to me."
"Just chips," Carl said self-consciously. "Sort of a late Christmas present and something for letting me borrow her mom for the weekend." Kim swallowed. He was taken aback.
"Very impressive," he managed.
Becky let go of Kim and went out into the foyer to gather her things and get her coat out of the front closet. Kim followed and went to the door.
"Now I want you in bed at your normal time, young lady," Tracy said. "You understand? The flu's making the rounds."
"Oh, Mom," Becky complained.
"I'm serious," Tracy said. "I don't want you missing school."
"Chill out, Mom," Becky said. "You have fun and don't be so nervous about..."
"I'll have a great time," Tracy said, interrupting her daughter before she could say something embarrassing. "But I'll have a better time if I don't have to worry about you. You have the phone number I gave you."
"Yeah, yeah," Becky intoned.
Then, brightening, she added,
"Ski the big burn for me."
"Okay, I promise," Tracy said, as she took Becky's coat from her daughter's arms. "I want this on."
"But we'll be in the car," Becky complained.
"I don't care," Tracy said, helping her daughter into the coat. Becky ran to Carl, who was standing in the doorway to the living room. She gave him a hug and got her mouth close to his ear.
"She's real nervous, but she'll be okay. And thanks for the earrings. I love them."
"You're welcome, Becky," Carl said, nonplussed. Becky ran to Tracy and gave her a quick hug before dashing out the door, held open by Kim. Outside, Becky ran down the stairs and waved to Kim to hurry up. Kim broke into a trot.
"Call if there's a problem," Tracy yelled from the porch. Kim and Becky waved as they got into Kim's car.
"She's such a worrywart," Becky said as Kim started the car.
Then she pointed ahead through the windshield.
"That's a Lamborghini. It's Carl's car, and it's awesome."
"I'm sure it is," Kim said, trying not to sound as if he cared.
"You should get one, Dad," Becky said.
She turned her head to look at the vehicle as they drove by.
"Let's talk about food," Kim said. "I was planning on picking up Ginger. I thought all three of us could go to Chez Jean."
"I don't want to eat with Ginger," Becky said poutingly.
Kim drummed his fingers on the steering wheel. The stress of the day at the hospital, even the meeting with Carl, had him on edge. He wished he'd had time to play some tennis. He needed some form of physical outlet. The last thing he wanted was a problem between Becky and Ginger.
"Becky," Kim began, "we've been through this before. Ginger likes your company."
"I just want to be with you, not your receptionist," Becky complained.
"But you will be with me," Kim said. "We'll all be together. And Ginger is more than my receptionist."
"I don't want to eat at that stuffy old restaurant either," Becky said with emotion. "I hate it."
"Okay, okay," Kim said, struggling to control himself. "How about we go to the Onion Ring on Prairie Highway? Just you and me. It's just up the road."
"Fabulous!"
Becky perked up, and despite her seatbelt, she managed to lean over and give Kim a peck on the cheek. Kim marveled at how adroitly his daughter could manipulate him. He felt better now that she had reverted to her normal, vivacious self, but after a few miles, Becky's comment began to gnaw at him again.
"For the life of me," Kim said, "I don't understand why you have this thing against Ginger."
"Because she made you and Mom break up," Becky commented.
"Good gravy," Kim snapped. "Is that what your mother says?"
"No," Becky said. "She says it was only part of it, but I think it was Ginger's fault. You guys hardly ever argued until Ginger."
Kim went back to drumming his fingers on the steering wheel. Despite what Becky had said, he was certain Tracy had to have put the thought in her mind. As he turned into the Onion Ring parking lot, Kim shot a glance in Becky's direction. Her face was awash in color from the huge Onion Ring sign. She was smiling in anticipation of their fast food dinner.
"The reason your mother and I got divorced was very complicated," Kim began, "and Ginger had very little..."
"Look out!" Becky cried.
Kim redirected his gaze through the windshield and saw the blurry image of a preteen on a skateboard off the right front fender. Kim jammed on the brakes and threw the steering wheel over to the left. The car lurched to a stop, but not before colliding with the rear of a parked car. There was the unmistakable sound of breaking glass.
"You smashed the car!" Becky shouted, as if it were a question.
"I know I smashed the car," Kim shouted back.
"Well, it's not my fault," Becky said indignantly. "Don't yell at me."
The skateboarder, who'd momentarily stopped, now passed in front of the car.
Kim looked at the child, and the boy irreverently mouthed, "Asshole." Kim closed his eyes for a moment to control himself. "I'm sorry," he said to Becky. "Of course it wasn't your fault. I should have been paying more attention, and I certainly shouldn't have yelled at you."
"What are we going to do?" Becky said.
Her eyes anxiously scanned the parking area. She was terrified lest she see one of her schoolmates. "I'm going to see what happened," Kim said as he opened his door and got out. He was back in seconds and asked Becky to hand him the registration packet from the glove compartment.
"What broke?"
Becky asked as she handed over the papers. "Our headlight and their taillight," Kim said. "I'll leave a note." Once inside the restaurant, Becky immediately forgot the mishap. It being Friday night, the onion ring was mobbed. Most of the crowd were young teenagers in a ridiculous collection of oversized clothing and punk hairstyles. But there were also a number of families, with lots of small children and even infants. The noise level was considerable, thanks to fussy babies and competing ghetto blasters. The onion ring restaurants were particularly popular with children, mainly because the kids could doctor their own gourmet burgers with a bewildering display of condiments. They could also make their own sundaes with an equivalent number of toppings.
"Isn't this an awesome place?" Becky commented, as she and Kim got into one of the order lines.
"Just delightful," Kim teased, "especially with the quiet classical music in the background."
"Oh, Dad," Becky moaned and rolled her eyes.
"Did you ever come here with Carl?" Kim asked. He really didn't want to hear the answer, because he had an inkling she had.
"Sure," Becky offered. "He took Mom and me here a couple of times. It was cool. He owns the place."
"Not quite," Kim said, with a certain satisfaction. "Actually, the Onion Ring is a publicly owned company. Do you know what that means?"
"Well, sort of," Becky said.
"It means a lot of people own stock," Kim said. "Even I own stock, so I'm one of the owners, too."
"Yeah, well, when I was here with Carl, we didn't have to stand in line," Becky said.
Kim took a deep breath and let it out. "Let's talk about something else. Have you thought any more about skating in the Nationals? I know the entry deadline is coming up."
"I'm not going to enter," Becky said, without hesitation.
"Really?" Kim questioned.
"Why not, dear? You are such a natural, and you won the state junior championship last year so easily." "I like skating," Becky said. "I don't want to ruin it."
"But you could be the best."
"I don't want to be the best in competition," Becky said.
"Well, gosh, Becky," Kim said. "I can't help but be a little disappointed. I'd be so proud of you."
"Mom said you would say something like that," Becky said.
"Oh, great," Kim exclaimed. "Your know-it-all therapist mother."
"She also said that I should do what I think is best for me."
Kim and Becky found themselves at the front of the line. A bored teenage cashier gazed at them with glassy eyes and asked them what they wanted. Becky looked up at the menu mounted over the bank of cash registers. She screwed up her mouth and stuck a finger in her cheek.
I don't know what I want."
"Have a burger," Kim said. "I thought that was your favorite."
"Okay," Becky said. "I'll have a burger, fries, and a vanilla shake."
"Regular or jumbo?" the cashier asked in a tired voice.
"Regular,"
Becky said.
"And you, sir?" the cashier asked.
"Oh, hell, let me see," Kim said. He too looked up at the menu. "A soup du jour and salad, I guess, and an iced tea."
"Comes to $7.90, the cashier said.
Kim paid, and the cashier handed him a receipt.
"Your number is 27.
Kim and Becky turned around and left the order area. It took some hunting, but they found a couple of empty seats at one of the picnic-style tables near the window. Becky squeezed in, but not Kim. He handed her the receipt and told her he had to use the men's room. Becky nodded absently. She had her eye on one of the cute boys from her school who happened to be sitting at the next table. It was like a broken field run for Kim to make his way across the restaurant to the anteroom leading to the restrooms. There were two phones, but both were tied up by teenage girls. Behind each was a line. Kim reached into his jacket pocket and extracted his cell phone. He punched in the numbers, leaned back against the wall, and held it to his ear.
"Ginger, it's me," Kim said.
"Where the devil are you?" Ginger complained. "Have you forgotten our reservations at Chez Jean were for 7:30?
We're not going, Kim said. I've had to change the plans. Becky and I are grabbing a bite at the onion ring on Prairie Highway. Ginger didn't respond. Hello, Kim said. Are you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here, Ginger said.
Did you hear what I said?
Of course I heard, Ginger said. I haven't eaten, and I've been waiting. You haven't called, and besides, you promised me we'd eat at Chez Jean tonight.
Listen, Kim growled, don't you give me a hard time, too. I can't please everybody. I was late picking up Becky, and she was starved.
That's nice, Ginger said. You and your daughter have a nice dinner together.
You're irritating me, Ginger.
Well, how do you expect me to feel? Ginger asked. For a year, your wife was your convenient excuse. Now I suppose it's going to be your daughter.
That's enough, Ginger, Kim snapped. I'm not going to get into an argument. Becky and I are eating here, and then we'll come by and pick you up.
Well, maybe I'll be here, and maybe I won't, Ginger said. I'm getting tired of being taken for granted.
Fine, Kim said. You decide. Kim cut off the connection and jammed the phone back into his jacket pocket. He gritted his teeth and cursed under his breath. The evening was hardly progressing as he would have liked. Kim's eyes involuntarily strayed to the face of a teenage girl waiting for one of the wall phones. Her lipstick was such a dark red it bordered on brown. It made her look like someone who'd succumbed to the elements on the north face of Mount Everest. The girl caught Kim staring at her. She interrupted her cow-like gum-chewing long enough to stick out her tongue. Kim pushed off the wall and went into the men's room to splash water on his face and wash his hands. The level of activity in the kitchen and service area of the Onion Ring was commensurate with the number of customers in the restaurant proper. It was controlled pandemonium. Roger Polo, the manager who regularly worked a double shift on Fridays and Saturdays, the Onion Ring's two busiest days, was a nervous man in his late 30s who drove himself and his staff hard. When the restaurant was as busy as it was while Kim and Becky awaited their order, Roger worked the line. He was the one who gave the burger and fries order to the short order chef, Paul, or the soup and salad orders to the steam table and salad bar worker, Julia, or the drink orders to Claudia. All the restocking and the routine ongoing cleanup was done by the gopher, Skip.
Number 27 coming up, Roger barked. I want a soup and salad.
Soup and salad, Julia echoed.
Iced tea and a vanilla shake, Roger called out.
Coming up, Claudia said.
Regular burger and medium fries, Roger ordered.
Got it, Paul said.
Paul was considerably older than Roger. His face was leathered and deeply creased. He looked more like a farmer than a cook. He had spent 20 years as a short-order chef on an oil rig in the Gulf. On his right forearm was a tattoo of a gusher with the word Eureka. Paul stood at the grill built into a central island behind the row of cash registers. At any given time, he had a number of hamburger patties on the cooktop. Each one was in response to an order. He organized the cooking by rotation so that all the burgers got the same amount of grill time. In response to the most recent wave of orders, Paul turned around and opened the chest-high refrigerator directly behind him.
Skip! Paul yelled when he realized the patty box was empty. Give me a box of burgers from the walk-in.
Skip put his mop aside.
Coming up!
The walk-in freezer was at the very back of the kitchen, next to the walk-in refrigerator and across from the storeroom. Skip, who'd only been working at the Onion Ring for a week, had found that a significant portion of his job was to carry various supplies from storage to the preparation area. He opened the heavy freezer door and stepped within. The door was mounted with a heavy spring and closed behind him. The interior was about 10 feet by 20 feet and illuminated by a single light bulb in a wire cage. The walls were surfaced in a metallic material that looked like aluminum foil. The floor was a wooden grate. The space was almost full of cardboard containers, except for a central aisle. To the left were the large cartons full of frozen hamburger patties. To the right were the boxes of frozen French fries, fish fillets, and chicken chunks. Skip flapped his arms against the sub-zero chill. His breath came in frosted clouds. Wishing to get back to the warmth of the kitchen, he scraped away the frost from the label of the first carton to his left to make sure it was ground meat. It read, Mercer Meats, Regulation 1-pound hamburger patties, extra lean,
Lot 6, Batch 9 through 14. Production, January 12th. Use by April 12th. Reassured, Skip tore open the carton and lifted out one of the inner boxes that contained 15 dozen patties. He carried them back to the refrigerator behind Paul and put them in.
"You're back in business," Skip said.
Paul didn't respond. He was too busy setting up the cooked burgers, while his mind kept a running account of the new orders Roger had given him. As soon as he could, he turned to the refrigerator, opened the patty box, and extracted the number of burgers he needed. But as he was about to close the door, his eye caught the label.
"Skip," Paul yelled, "get your ass back here."
"What's wrong?" Skip questioned. He'd not left the area, but had bent down to change the trash bag under the Central Island's rubbish disposal opening.
"You brought the wrong goddamn patties," Paul said. "These just came in today."
"What difference does it make?" Skip asked.
"Plenty," Paul said. "I'll show you in a second."
He then called,
"Roger, how many burgers you looking for after order 26?
Roger checked his tickets.
"I need one burger for 27, four for 28, and three for 29. That's 8 total."
"That's what I thought," Paul said.
He tossed the 8 patties he had in his hand onto the grill and turned around to get the box of patties out of the refrigerator. As preoccupied as he was, he didn't notice that the first patty he threw ended up partially covering another patty that was already on the grill. Paul motioned for Skip to follow him and spoke while he walked.
"We get shipments of frozen hamburger once every couple of weeks," he explained, "but we have to use the older ones first."
Paul opened the door to the walk-in freezer and was immediately confronted by the carton Skip had opened. Paul wedged the box he was carrying back into the carton and closed the lid.
"You see this date?" Paul asked while pointing to the label.
"Yeah, I see it," Skip said.
"Those other cartons back there have an older date," Paul said. "They have to be used first."
"Well, somebody should have told me," Skip complained.
"I'm telling you now," Paul said. "Come on, help me move these new ones to the back and the ones in the back to the front."
Kim had returned from the restroom and had managed to squeeze his 6-foot-plus frame into the seat next to Becky. There were 6 other individuals at the same table, including a 2-year-old whose face was smeared with ketchup. He was busy beating his half-eaten hamburger with a plastic soup spoon. "Becky, please be reasonable," Kim said while trying to ignore the 2-year-old. "I told Ginger that we'd pick her up after we finished eating." Becky took a breath and exhaled, slumping her shoulders. She was sulking, which was uncharacteristic for her.
"I mean, we've done what you wanted," Kim said. "We're eating together, just you and me, and it's not chez Jean."
"Well, you didn't ask me if I wanted to pick up Ginger," Becky said. "When you said we were coming here, I thought you meant we didn't have to see her tonight at all."
Kim looked off and tightened his jaw muscles. He loved his daughter, but he knew she could be frustratingly willful. As a cardiac surgeon, he was accustomed to people on his team following his orders. Paul returned from the rearranging in the walk-in freezer to face an exasperated Roger.
"Where you been?" Roger demanded. "We're way behind."
"Don't worry," Paul said. "Everything is under control."
Paul picked up his spatula and began slipping the fully cooked burgers into their respective buns. The patty that had been leaning up against another was pushed aside so that the one beneath could be removed.
"Ordering 30, Roger barked. 2 regular burgers and 1 jumbo.
"Coming up," Paul said.
He reached behind into the refrigerator to get the meat. Turning back around, he tossed them onto the grill. He then used his spatula to pick up the patty that had been draped over another. Flipping it back onto the grill, it again landed so that it was leaning on another and not flat against the cooktop. Paul was about to adjust it when Roger got his attention.
"Paul, you screwed up," Roger snapped. "What's wrong with you tonight?"
Paul looked up with his spatula suspended over the grill.
"Number 25 is supposed to be 2 jumbos, not 2 regulars," Roger complained.
"Shit, sorry," Paul said.
He turned back to the refrigerator to get 2 jumbo patties. After he tossed them onto the grill, he used his spatula to press them down. Jumbos needed twice the cook time of the regular burgers.
"And number 25 was supposed to have a medium fries," Roger said irritably.
He waved the ticket as if he were threatening Paul with it.
"You got it," Paul said.
He quickly filled a paper cone with the potatoes. Roger took the fries and put them on the number 25 tray and shoved it over to what was called the distribution counter.
Okay, Roger said to Paul. Number 27's ready to go. Where's the burger and fries? Come on, Paul, let's get on the ball.
All right, already, Paul said. Paul used his spatula to scoop up the patty that had spent most of its grill time on top of two other patties. He slipped it into a bun and placed it on the paper plate Roger had put on the countertop in front of him. Paul shoveled on some grilled onions, then filled another paper cone with French fries. Within seconds, the teenager on the distribution counter leaned over his goose-necked microphone and said,
"Pick up number 25 and number 27.
Kim stood up. "That's us," he said. "I'll get the food, but after we eat, we're going to pick up Ginger, and that's final. And I'm going to expect you to be pleasant, okay?"
"Oh, all right," Becky said reluctantly.
She stood up. "I'll get the food," Kim said. "You stay put."
"But I want to fix my own burger," Becky said.
"Oh, yeah," Kim said. "I forgot." While Becky dressed her burger with an impressive layer of various toppings, Kim picked out what he hoped would be the least offensive salad dressing. Then father and daughter returned to their seats. Kim was happy to see the ketchup-besmeared toddler had departed. Becky perked up considerably when the boy from her school asked for some of her French fries. Kim picked up his soup spoon and was about to sample the soup when his cell phone rang against his chest. He took the phone out and put it to his ear.
"Dr. Regis here," he said. "This is Nancy Warren," the nurse said. "I'm calling because Mrs. Arnold demands that you come in to see her husband."
"What about?" Kim asked. Becky used both hands to pick up her burger. Even so, a couple of sliced pickles fell out from beneath the layers of bread. Undaunted, she got her mouth around the behemoth and took a bite. She chewed for a moment, then examined the bitten surface.
"Mr. Arnold is very anxious," Nancy said, "and he says his pain medication isn't holding. He's also had a couple of PVCs.
Becky reached out and tugged on Kim's arm, trying to get him to look at the bitten surface of her burger. Kim motioned for her to wait while he continued his cellular phone conversation.
"Has he had a lot of PVCs?"
"No, not a lot," Nancy said, "but enough so that he's aware of them."
"Draw a potassium and double up on his pain meds. Is the intensivist there?"
"Yes, Dr. Silber is in the hospital," Nancy said, "but I think you should come in. Mrs. Arnold is insistent."
"I'll bet she is," Kim said with a dismissive chuckle. "But let's wait for the potassium level first. Also, check and make sure there isn't any marked abdominal distension." Kim disconnected his call. Mrs. Arnold was turning into a bigger pain in the neck than he'd imagined.
"Look at my hamburger," Becky said.
This book is continued on Cassette 2, Side 1.